Yeah. Speaking of the book, I really like the way it's laid out here. You have, you know, and we talked about this when we were going through it, but you have kind of the claims that are addressed and you kind of address them. And then at the end, you have these discussion questions. And then, as you mentioned earlier, you have the back of the book where everything is kind of summarized with this question and answer format. So what were you trying to accomplish here with this kind of format?
Well, we realized college students are busy and, you know, sometimes just a matter of, he has some of those zingers or some of those one-liners. And, you know, they can be very devastating if somebody just, you know, it creates doubt in the heart. And if they don't have a compelling answer to that, or they don't even realize there are compelling answers, they may just swallow that, you know, just hook, line, and sinker. And so we felt, well, we needed to have some sort of a tool where ideally people will read the whole book, right? But in case they don't, at least we give them a quick resource, you know, some sort of, you know, a primer where they kind of Cliff's Notes, right? Where they can look up, you know, one of the things that he keeps repeating ad nauseum almost at some of those interviews and, you know, and say, okay, yeah, there are answers. And I think part of it is he makes it look like that any intelligent person would agree with him. You know, and so we got four PhDs among the three of us, right? And so I remember my daughter, the one that enrolled there at, you know, at UNC, you know, she said, so Dad, you wrote the book just basically to make the point that intelligent people can believe the Bible, right? And I said, yeah, essentially, that's right. You know, because he almost makes it look like you have to be a simpleton or a country bumpkin, right? Or super gullible. In some of my teaching, and I've taught some of this in Sunday school classes or at conferences, you know, I talk to people about a spectrum, you know, that you have, on the one hand, you have extreme skepticism. And on the other hand, you have extreme naivete, or, you know, people who believe everything. And he makes it almost look like those are the only two options, when of course they aren't, right? I mean, on the one side, from extreme skepticism, there would be doubt, right? Doubt is different, I think, because doubt is open to evidence. Mm-hmm. But hardened skepticism basically raises the bar so high that you know, you can never satisfy a hardened skeptic with evidence. And on the other side, you know, there's not only this naive gullibility that believes anything, there's also discerning engagement. And so I think that is what we are trying to cultivate, especially with college students, you know, to say, yeah, you have questions, that's fine. You know, let's look at the issue, not in a simplistic way, because when you find, when we look at Ehrman's works closely, often he's the one who's very simplistic in the way he deals with a given issue. In many ways, he's just one of those historical critics, kind of like remember the Jesus seminar, or, you know, people who just already start out with this skepticism toward the resurrection, or, you know, they published the book, The Five Gospels. And so they put in red what they thought Jesus said. And there's almost nothing is in red.
All the pebbles that we put into a fishbowl. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, we talked about that when we covered Mitch Stokes' book, How to Be an Atheist, how skeptics aren't skeptical enough, taking their own claims and applying it to themselves and showing that, hey, be skeptical, but then actually be skeptical. So that speaks well to our continuing conversation. And as a video editor as well, who cuts up our episodes and makes little short clips for people to kind of devour, I appreciate how the book is laid out too, because it really helps. In fact, I had one a tweet. Someone responded, I think 3 weeks after we covered. There's an example in your book where Ehrman kind of claimed that the return of Jesus in I believe 1 and 2 Thessalonians are contradictory.
Yeah.
Because one says this will come quickly, and the other one says this comes first, and there's this contradiction. I was like, well, that's what the video is about. Did you click on the link? No, I didn't click on the link. I just know that it's wrong. Like, just because something happens first doesn't mean that something also can't happen quickly. And it seems like once you break it down and kind of get past the rhetoric and lay out what you've done in the book, you can actually see what the claim is, and then see the responses. I think too,
Different people have different issues, you know, and then so it's the kind of book where people can jump around. They can go straight to whichever chapter, you know, they're most interested in, and then you just try to be clear in what you cover in a given chapter. And then, like you said, Tony, break it down into maybe a few specific maybe claims Ehrman makes or questions he raises, and then address it directly. We just felt like, okay, he doesn't invite us to his, New Testament survey classes, but this is something we can put into the hands of hopefully, you know, many of his students, where he makes those claims. And so, you know, here are our answers, you know, for those who do want to know the other side, because he doesn't even acknowledge that there all is the issues side. He raises, scholars have addressed, you know.
I think that's one of the hindrances we have in the church today is not being proud of our history. We have 2,000 years of church history, and it seems like we have this idea that starting from 1952 with the invention of like the photocopier, that's when true scholarship started. We didn't know anything before then. It was just people that were attributing the lightning to God bowling type deal. But if you think about it, you know. We as a collective have been writing books against claims against heresies and the like under persecution, under political strife. I mean, we've had to deal with the Romans, the Muslims, the Roman Catholics, the rise and continuation of the Reformation, and then the 20th century with the academia coming in and becoming liberal, and then if you think that you have something new, it's probably heresy. That's the joke. But it seems like if you're writing something about the Christian tradition, there's probably somebody within that span of 2,000 years that has at least touched on it and talked about why there might be these differences in responding to it.
Yeah, that's true. C.S. Lewis called that, as you know, chronological snobbery. You know that. Critical scholars today, you know, say they know the truth better than those who are much closer to the time. And so, I deal with that quite a bit in my own writing that, you know, people find that just because an article is 5 or 10 years old, it's irrelevant. And somehow if an article was written like this year or last year, it's more accurate, you know, and that's demonstrably false. Yeah.